Welcome to episode 148. A little shout out to the Stooges there, Bear. Episode 148 of Breaking Kayfabe with Bowdrin and Barry. Here on this show, we don't just break kayfabe on wrestling. We break kayfabe on sports, movies, television, pop culture. We do just about everything, Barry. Got a packed show this week. Are you ready, my man? I heard you're a little under the weather.
Non-Ethiopian
nature.
No, here's the irony. The stomach actually seems okay, but my son is a camp counselor, home from college, obviously, scheduled to go back in 3.5 weeks to college. We'll see what happens with that, obviously. Wow. But he's a camp counselor, came home on Friday and goes, you know, I'm congested. My throat is tingly. Said, why don't you rest? I woke up yesterday, Jeff, and I'm congested. And this is a funny story, too, but I don't know if it's funny, but fuck it. I'll tell it anyways. But exactly. But, you know, I'm congested. My throat's scratchy. I feel like shit. I slept last night for over 9 hours. Jeff, I haven't slept for over 9 hours in probably 20 years, even longer, since my first was born. But my wife today says, you know, she goes, why don't you just bag this week and not do the podcast? And I looked at her and I said,
what?
Well, exactly. And I said, let me explain something to you. I said, we have never missed a week because this is my proudest accomplishment.
Yeah, you miss an episode because you don't feel good. I survived fucking cancer. Mrs. Rose that?
Well, I did. I explained to her. I said, we've gone through movings from out of state, from Florida to Georgia, weddings, vacations, minor sicknesses, cancer treatments. And then I said, were you aware that Jeff Court recorded 2 episodes from his bed in the hospital? And she said, yeah, I think you have to record today. I said, exactly.
I thought maybe Mrs. Rose was willing to fill in as a co-host. We would love to have her, you know.
Oh, yeah, you would absolutely love that. But hey, Jeff, the two best friends, and somebody brought that up to me this week, the two best friends you never knew you had, we are back. Jeff, is this 148? We're at episode 148?
148 and counting.
That is absolutely crazy. We have never missed a week. I've said that almost every episode. That's a huge accomplishment. And before we get into this week, because we really do have a full agenda, big shout out, best wishes, get well, Shard Johnson. Jeff, let me ask you too. Shard, is that short for anything? Or is it Shard?
I do not know. That's a good question.
All right. Shard Johnson, he's a Floridian. He is as
far
as
he's got that going for him.
Absolute. Well, yeah, that's right. Exactly. He is the first listener that I'm aware of that actually has COVID-19. He's got the coronavirus. Been in the hospital, got some congestion. I've been messaging with him. I know he's very active, feeling a lot better. But, you know, big guy, keeping you in our thoughts. And we know that you're going to kick this. And I just want to give the guy a shout out because we love him.
Absolutely. So get yourself better there, Shard, and get back on the board posting inappropriate stuff. So on this episode, we are going to be discussing our match of the week, Barry. We're going to Japan. I know people love when podcasts go to Japan because, of course, the inevitable Dave Meltzer 5-star match jokes come out. I will tell you that this is a match with 4 absolute legends of Japanese wrestling. However, as I texted Barry earlier this week, not a 5-star match, 3.5 stars. But there's lots to discuss involving the backstory of this match that I think is pretty interesting. We're also going to be taking a look at some AEW. That's right. We're going current wrestling. We're going to be discussing AEW, yay, nay, or meh, as far as stuff that's happening in that promotion that we like, that we don't like, and we really don't know what's going on. We're going to be discussing briefly, because Barry and I have a spoiler for the next episode. We're going to be talking about the Go-Go's documentary. In brief, we're going to be discussing, Barry, I know you're ready for a good food topic. We haven't done that in a while. The best chicken restaurants out there, folks. So, you know, Barry, he practically gets wood when we talk food.
Oh, practically.
We're going to be talking about a special 40-year anniversary when it comes to Barry's beloved CWF. And maybe we'll throw a couple other things in there if you're good. So, Barry, you ready to go, my man?
Yeah. Was this like a 20-hour show we're doing?
It could be. We could be looking at a 605 level event here. I just hope Lou doesn't fall asleep on the production duties there. Are you ready?
Let's do it.
Okay, let's go, first of all, to our match of the week. We're going July 21st, 1986. I'm going to put it out there. One of the greatest tag teams of all time, Riki Choshu and Yoshiaki Yatsu, taking on Killer Khan and the super strong machine who was Junji Harada. A couple things before I throw it to Barry for his thoughts on the match. So there's a little backstory on this match, and I actually reached out to a now official friend of the show, Fumi Saito, about the backstory on this. So what had happened was when Riki Choshu and his group of Ishigun left New Japan to jump to the Giant Baba's All Japan rings, he brought along with him a lot of guys that were quote-unquote his guys, including Yatsu, including Animal Hamaguchi, including Strong Machine, Shunji Takano, Hiro Saito, a bunch of guys like that. And Killer Khan was, of course, still wrestling in the United States at the time. But what happened was Super Strong Machine, Shunji Takano, and Hiro Saito all split off from within the Ishigun group and formed a group of their own. It was like a group within a group, and they called themselves the Calgary Hurricanes. They would come to the ring, and they would have the flag. You know, like when the hurricane flags go up in Florida whenever there's a hurricane warning bear? They would carry those flags with them to the ring. I guess the whole Calgary reference, because that's where a lot of I know that's where Junji Harada first got his big major push. By the way, here's an interesting story. Junji Harada, Japanese guy, goes to Calgary. So I don't know if it was Stu or Bruce Hart or whatever. Guess what gimmick they give him, Barry?
What was it?
Sunny Two Rivers. Japanese that's guy right. Wrestling as an Indian. I think that's rather odd. Something you could not get away with today. Let's just put it that way. So anyway, so we've got this group within a group that split off from Choshu's group. Killer Khan comes in. Killer Khan joins the Calgary Hurricanes group. And he and Choshu, we actually, I think, God, Barry, was like in either our first, second, or third episode of this show that we did. We reviewed the blow-off match to the feud with Riki Choshu versus Killer Khan in a Texas death match. Do you remember that match?
I do, yes. Okay. Oh, my God, that was great.
Yeah, and much like this match, Killer Khan comes to the ring walking through the crowd, and he's essentially wearing a Ku Klux Klan outfit, except it's black. And it's, you know, because he's a very large guy. By the way, from what I understand, Killer Khan, nicest guy you'll ever meet, has his own restaurant, I think, in Tokyo. Yep. And just loves having wrestling fans come in and talk to him about his past. But here, of course, he's playing the ferocious heel. And so let's think. That's about it. All I got to offer. Barry, I'll throw it to you. Tell us what you thought of this match.
Yeah, too. So touching on that, so I pulled up Junji Harada on, I guess it was Wikipedia. I went to Google and it came up, and it said his father was the famous Indian wrestler, Billy Two Rivers. And I was like, what? What is this? And I was going to ask you, and I think you just answered the question of why Wikipedia says that. Wikipedia is interesting to me also, Jeff, because whenever somebody will say something and they'll be like, well, I know this is accurate because I read it on Wikipedia. Yeah, exactly. My experience with Wikipedia is about a 50-50 shot right there, that 50% of it is completely bogus. And in my head, I'm going, why does it say Junji Harada's father as a shoot is Billy Two Rivers, who's a Canadian Indian? You know, I was going to say Native American, but I guess he's Native Canadian. But it didn't make any sense to me as to why it was saying it. Now it makes sense because, as you said, I wasn't aware he spent time in Calgary as an Indian.
I'm just here to provide information, Barry. That's all.
And you're doing a fine job. So Killer Khan is interesting, too. He comes out. It does look like a KKK type of gimmick. It's all black, though, but it's really ominous. And when he wears this black hood in the ring, and it's like a full black robe as well, he looks like he's a foot taller than everybody else. And it's really striking. Unfortunately, a lot of that ends when the hood comes off, because you can see he's not as tall as we thought he was. And he kind of looks like Barry Darso here. He's got short hair. He's balding, but he's got short hair. I don't think I've ever seen Killer Khan with short hair. And he's got what's like black eye makeup, much like Barry Darso's Repo Man character. So I thought that was interesting. There's a great kick sequence between Choshu and Super Strong Machine, where Choshu is just laying him in there too, hardcore. Super Strong Machine looks really good here too. And in my opinion, I think actually everybody looks good here. Killer Khan, who I agree, apparently he's the nicest guy, very funny, apparently, with a great sense of humor. When you go over to Japan, he loves to have fans go over to his restaurant, but he's not at the same level as a professional wrestler as the other three. And that's not a knock on him. He probably had the most success in the U.S. of any of those guys. I don't even think probably. I'm sure that he did. But at the same time, when it comes to professional wrestling, especially in Japan, you know, Yoshiaki Yatsu, you know, his history, the guy was in the Olympics, but he tried out for the 76 Olympics, made the 80 Olympics until, I guess, Japan followed America's lead and then boycotted and then tried to get back in later. But, you know, Yatsu to me is a stud, and Choshu obviously is legendary. Killer Khan, not on the same level as a wrestler as those guys, but there's a great sequence. Yatsu's got Killer Khan on the mat and he's slapping his face, and Khan looks legitimately stunned or pissed. And he gets up, and it, for a minute there, I'm questioning. I'm going, are these guys getting ready to shoot on each other? Obviously, they weren't, because they locked up, you know, 30 seconds later back into wrestling. But I thought that was interesting, too. And Yatsu's suplexes, Yatsu and Choshu, their suplexes are through the roof. Yatsu especially, we've talked about him before, and we saw Yatsu in Florida, Jeff. What was that, 82, when he was in
It was the early part of the 80s.
Yeah, and then I know, I think
now,
he left
now was
us.
He, I know for whatever reason, when he went to World Class, World Class, they called him Tola Yatsu.
Tola Yatsu.
I have no idea why they changed his first name.
Oh.
Usually it's they always call the Japanese guy Mr. something, you know, like Mr. Fujinami or Mr.
That's
Yatsu.
That's how it used to be. Right? That's
they never had first names.
No, we had Mr. Fujinami in Florida. Like, somebody looks at it and goes, do you think the ring announcer can pull this off? And they decide, nah, there's no way that that a guy in Oskaloosa, Florida can pull this off.
Bruce Tharp would have not had a problem. That's one.
Bruce Tharp being the only one that could have actually pulled this off. But Yatsu looks great. I was such a fan of this guy and his Japanese work. I don't think he ever did much in the U.S. that was memorable. But, you know, and he's got quite the history, Jeff, if you remember, too. I think he ran afoul of the organized crime families in Japan from gambling debts. I know that he's had diabetes. I believe he lost part of his leg last year, if I'm remembering correctly. Part of his leg was amputated. And it's a real shame. I don't think Yatsu ever reached full potential of what he could have been, because I think he could have been arguably one of the best, at least right there with some of the other guys. And I don't think he ever got that level. I know he gained weight. The diabetes was bad. The gambling debts. I heard, you know, there was threats on his life at one point. But I was such a fan of the guy overall. And I think your assessment of the star rating of this is probably accurate. 3.5 stars. I think what this match has going for it is, A, it's not boring. There's no rest holds. There's no, you know, there's no arm bar for 5 minutes. This is constant motion. But they're not gelling in a way that I guess you would expect at least three out of the four of these guys to gel. And again, I'm removing Khan, but at the same time, you would expect, I don't know, maybe more of chain wrestling, more of a gel. It's essentially a brawl. I thought the ending was great. It was very dramatic, and that I really liked. But I think 3.5 stars is probably right on the money. Jeff, you would be 100% correct with that.
Well, a couple things real quick. First of all, when it comes to Yatsu, Yatsu around the 84, 85, 86, I know that's when, actually, I think he still does it, when Meltzer was doing a top 100 list for the end of the year awards. And I know one year, Yatsu was like, I want to say like number 4 or 5 in the world. I mean, he was he was an incredible, incredible wrestler. And when he made the jump with Choshu, who was sort of like, I don't know if it's his mentor or a guy that he looked up to, when they made the jump, and I think I've mentioned it on this show before, and Giant Baba made the decision to make Yatsu the main partner for Riki Choshu and sort of pushed aside Animal Hamaguchi, who had been Riki Choshu's longtime partner because, you know, Hamaguchi was a little bit smaller. He was a little bit older. And, you know, and it was a decision that, you know, really paid off because Yatsu was, you know, such in his prime and really brought something out of Choshu. And of course, having new partners also helped and stuff like that. So then I think Choshu had signed a 2-year contract with Baba, fulfilled the 2-year contract, and then jumped back to New Japan and took the majority of the guys with him. There were a couple that stayed with Baba, and Yatsu was the primary person within that group, the Ishigun group, that decided to stay. I think Shunji Takano, who we also mentioned briefly, also stayed. Now, what happened at that point was, and whether it was related to the diabetes or not, I don't know, but Yatsu was made Jumbo Tsuruta's partner when Jumbo Tsuruta and Tenryu right. split their famous tag team. Yatsu started putting on, I mean, like a lot of weight. And I mean, he probably gained a good 40 to 50 pounds where it was like, you looked from like March of 1 year to March of the next year. And you're like, damn, like what happened to that guy? And right. the thing that's amazing is you're talking about an Olympic caliber amateur wrestler. You're right. He was on the team. And I think they boycotted because of the thing with the Russians in Afghanistan. But the amazing thing is, and I think there might have been one, maybe Kurt Angle had thought about doing this, a guy that was in professional wrestling for the better part of, you know, 8 or 9 years decides he wants to try out for the Japanese Olympic team and go from being a pro wrestler. And think about what that means, Barry, to going back to amateur Olympic wrestling, which is a completely 180 degree difference because you're dealing with, you know, allowing guy, you know, in pros, you're giving you the guys, your bodies, your, you know, everything is working light whenever possible to now it's all about resisting everything the guy does. And the fact that the guy was even a candidate to do that just shows what an incredible, incredible athlete he was. You know, just amazing thing. Now, the other thing I wanted to mention was the machine's character, contrary to what anyone might believe, did not come into existence with Andre, Blackjack Mulligan, and, who was the other guy that was one of the machines in WWF? Do you remember?
Was a big guy too, right?
Bill Eadie.
You're absolutely right. And so
the best worker of all three.
Yeah, exactly. At least at that point, certainly.
Right.
But the machines were started in New Japan. And I want to say that it was Junji Harada. And it was another wrestler whose name I can't remember right now, who I believe may have been Korean. And I remember when they first came in the rings of New Japan, they'd done a couple tours that my friend Tom Nash told me that he thought they were one of the most innovative tag teams he'd ever seen as far as, you know, the double team moves and stuff like that they were doing. And when Tom Nash became part of the Blackhearts, they stole a lot of their moves from the machines. Now, mind you, this was at a time when like Davey Boy Smith and Dynamite Kid, Satoru Sayama, you know, the Cobra, George Takano, when all these guys were there and the guys that Tom Nash stole the moves from were not those guys. It was Junji Harada and the machines. So while you're right in saying that Junji Harada may have been the least known of the four guys, Junji Harada as the super strong machine was a hell of a worker. And, you know, although he was never pushed as the main eventer and certainly not in all Japan, he was a guy that was really capable of going out having a good match. You're right. For whatever reason, this match did not click the way I had expected it to, especially after we had reviewed the Killer Khan Riki Choshu match so early in this podcast history. But this was not like a 5-star classic from Japan. This was actually, I believe, a spot show too. And what disappointed me a little bit was what I said at the beginning of this was that Choshu and Yatsu are one of the greatest tag teams of all time. And quite frankly, there are spots in here where they go to a stuffed pile driver and they kind of mess it up a little bit.
Oh, yeah.
But, you know, literally for about a 2 or 3 year period, they were one of the great teams in the world and were absolutely fantastic. Their matches with Tsuruta and Tenryu are just absolute. You know, I think we've reviewed one, if not two of their matches, but between those two teams, just absolute classics. And I mentioned this before. But Terry Funk, after seeing a Tsuruta Tenryu versus Choshu and Yatsu match, called Dave Meltzer, I believe from Japan, and said, I think I just saw the greatest tag team match I've ever seen in my life. Now, this is somebody, mind you, that teamed with his brother Dory and had matches on a nightly basis with the Briscoes. So for him to say that, you know, that really holds a lot of water with me, Barry.
Yeah, absolutely, too. And I remember you mentioning that, too, when we actually reviewed one of those matches. So, Jeff, question posed to you at this moment, and Sweet Lou as well, if Sweet Lou wants to chime in on this one. Better tag team, Yatsu Choshu, Yatsu Tsuruta?
Oh, definitely Choshu and Yatsu.
Okay.
If you had said Choshu and Hamaguchi, that would have been a real close one, because Hamaguchi, the stuff with him and Choshu in New Japan, off the charts. They were an unbelievable team. But when they put Choshu and Yatsu together in All Japan, they also had some stellar matches.
Yeah. I never thought, so Hamaguchi too, and I know that there was a drop-off because he was a little bit older as well, but I never thought he was quite at the same level as somebody like Yatsu, but I don't know. That's a personal opinion with that one.
Well, keep your damn opinions to yourself,
Lawrence. Oh, yeah. I'm known for that. Absolutely. Sure.
All right. Let's talk a little AEW All Elite Wrestling. So I'll be candid with you, Barry. A lot of times when I watch All Elite Wrestling, there are certain things I fast forward through. There are certain things that I watch that I think are really interesting. And, you know, there's some parts, quite frankly, like where I want to watch it, but really not super close. So maybe I'll turn the volume down because I'm in the middle of doing something and I'm kind of watching it with a side glance. So I came up with a list of yay, nay, and meh. Okay. So just to start the conversation, I'll start off with some stuff that I think about AEW that is yay. Okay.
All right.
Chris Jericho. Chris Absolutely. Jericho is freaking gold. Now, as Barry has pointed out, Jericho, perhaps not in the fighting shape he was when he was 25, but, you know, the guy's, is he 50 yet or getting close?
Right there. Yep.
So we'll slide him a little bit on that. Okay. MJF, my God, Barry, the promo the other night was like the new fucking gold standard. It was amazing. Did you see it?
I did. So let me ask you a question too with this. And when you said, why don't we discuss some of the real highlights of AEW? So I came up with a list of 10 things that I think AEW does right. Top of my list was Jericho. I mean, first off, because he's at a different level with the way that he carries himself. Even look, 2 weeks ago or 3 weeks ago, he did the whole demo god thing. They fucking sold out of these t-shirts in a minute. Jericho can take anything and make it work now. A little bit of the bubbly, Le Champion. This is shit he's just creating like on the fly. And it's catching on and it works. So
he literally may be one of the smartest guys over the last 25 to 30 years that the business has ever seen, because he has that innate knack for coming up with something that there's not a lot of guys, let's be honest, that can do that. I mean, there are guys that are very, you know, we talk about Terry Funk as being a guy that's very smart to the business, could see things coming down the road, you know, and Jericho has that sort of innate ability, and it's not something that everybody has. I can tell you that.
Yeah, and Jericho strikes me as a guy that is going to do what is the right thing for the business. You know, years ago when he was in the WWE, he put over Fandango on a pay-per-view. And Fandango at that point was, I guess, going to get some sort of a minor push, but it was minor. But Jericho did the job clean, but Jericho did the job clean for a lot of guys. In my opinion, he's so smart that he does the right thing for professional wrestling, but it doesn't hurt him at all because he's so innovative and so creative, he's able to bounce back. Now, getting on to what you said about MJF, look, MJF's promos are at a different level as well. This is, you're looking at the future of professional wrestling, and we're not, you know, we're not fucking Nostradamus by actually saying that, Jeff, because anybody can see it at this point. My question is, I know that he's getting a world title shot against Jon Moxley, I believe, on their next pay-per-view. Are they going to give MJF the title? And the reason I say this is what I like about AEW are the clean finishes. Essentially, you know, not a lot of DQs, if any DQs, not a lot of countouts or any of this. These are a lot of clean finishes. So I don't see in this match where, you know, there's going to be a DQ finish or a screw job in some form. But MJF is also at this stage, and this is something I like about AEW, the win-loss record. I like the fact they put that up every week. That's unique to me. Will he suffer his first loss at Jon Moxley, or is he going to become the new champion? And if he does become the new champion, is it too soon for him?
No, those are all valid points. You know, here's the thing. I did not put Moxley in my yays, nays, or my meh. I don't know whether or not he's the guy to carry the company because, you know, history says unless you got friggin' Hogan, it's always better when the babyface is chasing the heel champion. That's like always been wrestling's best
absolutely
pattern.
Absolutely 100% you're correct with that, Jeff.
And I
you
wonder
go back
if
to professional wrestling, it's always been that way whenever there was a successful promotion.
Yeah, and I don't know whether or not Moxley would be better off chasing MJF after losing the belt to him. But, you know, I mean, that's just something I just happened to think of, and maybe that's the way they should go. Is MJF, you're right, hasn't been in the business long. Is he ready for that, to carry the promotion? Because that's what he's going to have to do.
Right.
So, anyway, my number three, yay. Barry, I've said before, and I continue to say, I'm not a fan of the women's wrestling that's currently going on in this country. Just my own personal opinion. I know some people love it. Some people, agree with me and don't. But I will say that one of my favorite parts of the AEW show every single week is the stuff they're doing with Dr. Britt Baker. It's absolutely hilarious. The girl that plays like her flunky.
Rebel.
The facial expressions on both of them are great. I know that they're trying to work something with, who is it, Swole? So those vignettes are absolute classic stuff. And to me, that's the best stuff going on in ladies wrestling.
Yeah, Big Swole, who is the wife of Cedric Alexander, who's a performer in the WWE that's probably a lot better than the push he's currently getting. You're right.
Certainly, that he would be the only one in the WWE.
Right. Well, that's, I guess I described about 90% of the roster. But at the same time, Britt Baker is and they realize it. The cool thing is they've realized it because every week she's getting a segment now where she comes out. She's got the boot on, you know, she's got the broken ankle, whatever it is. And she's
nose
just
tape.
Nose tape. And here's somebody that, you know, was brought on as she's a beautiful woman. She's very competent in the ring as well, but was brought on as a baby face. But she has really found her stride in this disgruntled, smarmy heel. The AEW women's division has taken a lot of heat, probably deservedly so as well. And I do like the current champion. I feel that she is a very strong wrestler. Riho was not, I mean, not to knock her, but she looked like a 10-year-old schoolgirl. I just didn't get the appeal. And overall, I did like Chris Statlander. She's injured. But for the most part, there's been a lot of faltering with this division.
Let me ask you something real quick, Barry. Popped in my head. Less physical credibility, Riho or Marco Stunt?
Honestly, change the genitals and they're the same human being. The Marco Stunt thing is interesting to me because some people really like him. And one of the big defenses of Marco Stunt that I constantly hear is let him live his dream. Let him live his dream. And I don't really understand what that means from the standpoint that, you know, I have dreams that nobody ever let me live. Jeff, you've got them.
You have dreams that would trouble people, quite frankly, if they knew
absolutely. About it. But I should be allowed to live them, right, with that kind of logic. Marco Stunt, and maybe he's being booked correctly because, look, they're not putting this guy over majorly. So I can't find a lot of fault with it. But, you know, he is like 5'2". I'm going to assume he's about 120 to 130 pounds max. You know, I don't buy
Let
him.
Me ask that. You. Let
sure.
me ask you.
Sure.
Would you object to him as much? And again, this is something that just popped in my head. If he was made like a heel manager, a guy that obviously can take bumps, but would go out there sort of almost like a miniaturized version of Sammy Guevara, who I'm going to get to in a second.
I hope so.
The guy that's the shit stirrer at ringside, who when the time comes for it, can take a bump for a babyface. See, now that I wouldn't have a problem with.
Yeah, and that's a Jeff, great observation. Maybe that's the route that they're going with him to get him over as this undersized baby face that continually gets beat down. I'll play Booker here for a minute, Jeff.
I'll
steal this gimmick, blatantly steal it on air. But maybe they're going to do that. And then maybe he's going to become so disgruntled at getting his ass beat every week that it becomes some sort of a heel manager. And that's probably where his future is, you know?
Yeah. Okay, next, my fourth yay, Taz on promos.
Yep.
Wow, this guy's been really good on his promos, Bear.
Really good on his promos, really good on comp. Here, yes. Last week, and this was interesting to me, and I don't know if I love this that much because I see fault with it at times, but he's so good that he does commentary. Then when it comes time for Ricky Starks and Brian Cage, he then leaves commentary and starts doing promos. Yeah. That's how good he is. Give him a mic. He is really, really
and his commentary, popular. The funny thing is he's fair in his commentary.
Right.
You know? And as a heel, you would think he would be doing the stuff where he'd only be, you know, pushing the heels. But he's actually right on point and pretty fair with his commentary. And like you said, he goes over and does his great. And Brian Cage, good Lord, that guy looks like if you pop him with a pen, he'd just like sort of just start blowing away. I mean, that guy is just, wow, I don't think he can get any bigger.
No, he is really big. And we met him. He had a couple of matches in Philadelphia at the 2300 Arena, the old ECW Arena, and going back maybe 2-3 years ago, maybe a little longer than that. And it was Brian Cage versus, I think, either Ricochet or Sammy Callahan. But we got to meet him, and he was the nicest guy. And I took photos of my son with him, which, you know, they're almost the same size, obviously. My son is like one of Brian Cage's legs. His entire body, but real nice guy. What I like about Brian Cage, and I haven't really seen this in AEW yet, but I definitely saw it with Lucha Underground and other promotions he's worked in, is that he can do some amazing things for a guy his size. And I don't think he's really shown what he can do in AEW. And Ricky Starks, you know, that this is what I like. Ricky Starks is right up there. You know, you just mentioned MJF. You're going to mention Sammy Guevara, obviously, momentarily. But AEW's done a really good job of taking young talent and giving them the ball and saying, go out there and do something with this, you know? And a guy like Ricky Starks has only been around AEW now, 2-3 weeks? And he's already like in the main event. And because they've seen the potential. Sammy Guevara, they've obviously seen massive potential. Fucking MJF is getting a world title shot. So unlike the WWE, which, you know, continually will hold down young talent based off of political reasons, AEW sees the vision here and is like, you know what? Give these guys a shot. If they tank, if they fail, we can bump them down, but give them a shot. And these guys appear to be succeeding. And I love that.
Yeah. And he cut a hell of a promo last week, too, by the way. And let me ask you, the guy that came, because I got to be honest, as I've mentioned before, I do not watch the WWE. The guy that came in as Cody's buddy or best friend, and the name they gave him was not the name he had in WWE.
Oh, you know him? Matt Cardona, which I believe is his shoot name. They brought him in. So Jeff, just to go off of that as well, I have not watched the WWE or even NXT, which actually bothers me a little bit because I did like that since I quit a month or two ago when I said that. So I haven't, but that is the guy, artist formerly known as Zack Ryder. And okay. That's another really good point, because Zack Ryder and his tag partner, Brian Myers, I completely forget what name he used in the WWE, but Zack Ryder years ago was getting over, and he was the internet champion. If I'm correct, he made himself the internet champion, and he was over. And he was over based off of his own actions. And I guess the WWE, because they didn't get him over, held him down for years, finally wind up cutting him, you know, 5-10 years later, whatever it's been. But, can he ever get over again? Hopeful, because he was super over. Good talent. I don't think he's earth shattering, but brought him in as Cody's friend. I would imagine when you bring a guy in as your friend, that we all know in professional wrestling.
Trouble brewing.
Trouble brewing, exactly. So, but hey, whatever works, right?
Yeah. Okay, next on my yays, the aforementioned Sammy Guevara. Now, let's be honest. Sammy, about a month and a half ago, some stuff came out that he had said in the past that was absolutely just fucking idiotic and, reprehensible to boot. But, you know, Sammy's what, 20 years old? He's not, doesn't have a lot of years on him. So my thought, Barry, is, you know, things that are, the internet never forgets, and things that are said years before, and I'm, trust me, completely reprehensible. I'm not forgiving that at all. But let's be honest, at the time he said it, he might have been 15 or 16 years old. So should he have been given some slack for that? Or is it, no, this is a reprehensible comment. We got to fucking bring the hammer down on him.
Yeah. So look, I want to say he said it when he was in his early 20s, like 20 or 21, right around.
I thought he was like 20 now.
I think he's like 23 or 24. Okay. He's still a really young guy. Yeah, I'm not sure. And look, you're right. I don't want to defend, but first off, we should say he said something and he didn't physically do anything. The other aspect is, in reading through the lines of what he said, he was basically saying that he wanted to have sex with Sasha Banks. He used a very poor, uneducated choice of words. I would like to rape Sasha Banks. But I also understand the vernacular, and what he was saying is that, yeah, he finds her attractive and really wants to take her to Pound Town. You know, again, really poor choice in saying it. However, he also said this several years before joining AEW. Should he have been reprimanded? He should have been, because he needs to know that's completely unacceptable, especially in this world today. It's not right. So, yes, he should have been reprimanded. Did they do the right thing? I think they did. They suspended him for a few weeks. He went to sensitivity training, and he's back. And that's where it should be. I think that's a fair and just punishment.
And my apologies. He's actually 27 years old. So, maybe he should have known better when he made those comments. Now, all that being said, an incredible talent. What is it? Jericho said something to him. How do you say son of a bitch in Spanish? And he said, El son of a bitch, or something like that. Because apparently Jericho, who worked in Mexico, knows how to speak Spanish. And Sammy Guevara, who's from Houston, supposedly, according to what I read, doesn't know how to speak Spanish. Right. So, that makes it for a pretty fun joke. A guy, and I think I've mentioned this before, that reminds me, and I only mean this in the most positive way, of Buddy Landell, in that this guy can absolutely get his ass kicked and lose none of his heat. When they go out there as a foursome, it's usually Sammy that looks at the lights. But he doesn't lose any of his heat, because when he gets out there and, he's taking bumps and he's just being I think when I first saw him, I compared him to a young Tully Blanchard. But I think maybe he's more like a young Buddy Landell that we saw like in Mid-South in 83, 84, 85, a guy that can lose but not lose any of his heat and maintains his credibility with the fans. Barry, what do you think?
Yeah, Jeff, you are spot on. Once again this week, you're batting 1,000. He is, I like the Buddy Landell reference too. It's interesting too, because he's put in a top position week after week, does the job week after week, does not lose one ounce of his heat. So yeah, you're really right on top. He can do a promo. He's great in the ring. He's got that face and that attitude that you want to punch.
Absolutely.
And that's great for a heel, a snotty heel, big, big, big future in wrestling.
Yes. So my last yay, and I'll be honest, when the gimmick first started, I didn't think I was going to like it, but I'm really getting that kick out of Hangman Page and the whole drinking gimmick. It's hilarious.
Yes.
And when I saw him in New Japan, I was not a huge fan of his. Become a much bigger fan of his in AEW. And, it's funny. I know that a lot of people may not agree with this, because a lot of sycophants that we know out there, of course, don't like Kenny Omega, because certain people don't like Kenny Omega. To me, he almost overshadows Kenny Omega. And maybe they're doing that 100%. On purpose.
100% he does. 100% he does. And
that actually leads into one of my nays, or actually it's one of my myths, the marginalization of Kenny Omega. When Kenny Omega and the Young Bucks signed with AEW and the promotion was still in its very early, the genesis of the promotion, Kenny Omega whether you like him or not, was the biggest American star in Japan by a wide margin. A guy that had helped sell out the Tokyo Dome. He was a real big fucking deal. And I know people hate to admit that. And I know there's a lot of people that don't like his wrestling style, but he was a really big deal. And Kenny Omega came over here, and Kenny Omega as a babyface just is not as good as the Kenny Omega that was in the Bullet Club.
It's not even close.
Yeah.
It's not even close.
But he came over, and instead of getting the push that I was expecting and making him the focal point of the promotion, he became part of a tag team. And by all accounts, they're a really good tag team. I know Dave Meltzer thought their match with the Young Bucks was like one of the greatest tag matches of all time. I got to be honest with you. I still haven't watched the match. But, you know, the fact that he's still doing matches. But his position in the company is like he's kind of not a big deal in AEW in my mind. Am I missing something there, Bear?
No. Again, Jeff, and I'm just going to sit back because everything you're saying is so spot on this week. But he is. But that's a good point. What you also said is that maybe this is by design where Hangman Page is being positioned as the top guy in that team. Kenny Omega has been an utter disappointment in AEW. And I'm even going to go back to the early AEW, the stuff with John Moxley or the stuff with Pac, however you pronounce it. I just didn't find that this was the same Kenny Omega.
Yeah, and speaking of which, what happened to that guy?
I'm going to assume it's COVID related that he must be in England and can't get back over here.
Oh, okay. That's true. That's a valid point.
Yeah, that's my guess. But because I had that on my list too, but
yeah, we actually really like that guy.
Oh, he's fantastic. What a great heel he is. Kenny Omega, though, massively underwhelming to me. Just another guy on the roster at this point. I just don't see it. But Hangman Page, because Jeff, I made some notes of stuff that I thought they were doing well. And, going along with your Britt Baker and your Chris Jericho, Hangman Page is right there. When AEW started, I was ambivalent about Hangman Page. I didn't really care. I had seen him in Ring of Honor, and I was like, yeah, no, there's nothing, you know, not much really to see here. You talk, and then his early stuff with Jericho, where they were deciding who was going to be the world's champion when they had the tournament between the two of them and the match. And I'm like, how could you even put Hangman Page with Jericho? And I wasn't impressed. I got to tell you, a year later, I think the guy is fantastic. I think promos, I love the drinking gimmick, which initially I was kind of turned off to that. I think that's great. But his in-ring work is great. I love the way he comes out. He comes out like a house of fire. When he walks out, he's kind of shaking. I think they're onto something with him. I am a huge, huge fan of his.
Yeah, no, there's no question. So now I mentioned that Omega was a meh for me.
Yeah.
Here's my second meh.
Okay.
Cody as the centerpiece of the promotion. I just don't know. I don't know whether or not he's got enough to become, because, you know, if Moxley is supposed to be the promotion's world champion, and now they've created this TNT belt for Cody, and they have him taking on an array of what are essentially independent workers every week. So he's on TV every week, usually in their, if not their main event, one of their featured matches. I just don't know, Barry, am I missing the, but am I not 100% right on this, or should he be the focal point of the promotion?
So this, we're going to differ a little bit. So let me say, I'm not sure that he is the focal point of the promotion. I think with Cody is a, and I want to be accurate when I say it, slightly above mediocre talent as a wrestler. I think mentally in his understanding of the psychology of professional wrestling, I think he's at the very top. I think he's fantastic.
Yeah, he's obviously, business-wise, he's a very smart guy.
And I think he understands professional wrestling. And I think he can sometimes put aside his ego to do what's best for his business. And that I really respect. In ring, I would say he's slightly above mediocre. And maybe mediocre is being a little rough. He's just not a great talent. But I don't know if he's being positioned as the focal point. And I think this TNT title is a second, it's the Intercontinental title to, you know, it's the US title. It's not the world title. And I like the fact that he's doing this gimmick every week of facing new challengers, guys coming in. The Eddie Kingston, and I think Eddie Kingston,
yes,
huge thumbs
fantastic.
Up. Oh, fantastic, my God.
Yeah.
And wait till you see what he can do. I mean, at this point, you've seen one match. When he goes, he goes. And obviously, his promo was money. I did not like Warhorse.
No, he was like a miniaturized Ultimate Warrior, I felt like.
Oh, and miniaturized. He was this tiny guy trying to do the Ultimate Warrior. And I didn't like, and this is to go along with your mess segment right now, I didn't like the fact that the announcers were trying to put him over as like, we get asked all the time, when is Warhorse coming in? And I'm like thinking, who the fuck's asking you that, Jim Ross? Because like,
well, he's on Twitter, this, you know.
He's on Twitter, must be, because here's a guy that he looks tiny. I didn't get it. I don't like the gimmick. I didn't like it. But I do like what Cody's doing. And I think for me, and I think even the Cody MJF stuff was great. You know, I like Cody. Cody can't be the face of the promotion as far as the world champion. I like him where he is. You know, Cody opens up a lot of the shows now. It's the first or second match. He's doing the challenge. I like that. That's where Cody should be.
Do you think he would be better off as a heel?
I think eventually, yes, he would. And then we're going to see him as a heel. Yes, absolutely.
So here's another thing. Arn Anderson as Cody's advisor, I'm not a fan of, but the Arn Anderson and... completely having a brain fart, Barry. The new team that just came from the WWE to AEW, what's their name?
FTR.
FTR. That's what I was thinking, but I didn't want to make a mistake. Where he interrupts their contract signing. When I saw that and what he said, I was like, that's the fucking Arn Anderson that I know from Mid-Atlantic and WCW in the mid to late 80s. That was fantastic. And I want to see more of that Arn Anderson than the Arn Anderson that looks like he's at ringside taking notes. Because to me, that's just, you know, that's like Tully Blanchard sitting in the crowd with a notepad, you know. Somehow they're not doing anything with Tully Blanchard. They're not using Arn Anderson the way I think they should. But the one that interrupted the contract signing, that was the Arn Anderson that I've been missing. And I really hope that Arn Anderson comes more to light. And I really enjoyed that. So now let's just get to, I have one nay, and it's a real big nay.
Uh-oh.
Barry, if I live to be 100, I hope to never see another match involving fucking thumbtacks. Please, let's eliminate that gimmick.
Yeah, and I know that you hate it, and it was funny because I think as the match was taking place or right after, you're texting me going, do they really have to do fucking thumbtacks? And you're right. Look, at this point, we don't have to. And what they did with Ricky Starks last week looked really dangerous. That was a decent amount of blood. Those thumbtacks were obviously deep into his skin. That wasn't one of those like little cuts. So that was a lot of blood coming from Ricky Starks.
Well, and they had just done it. Was it the week before or maybe
the
2 weeks before?
No,
yeah,
the week
so it's
before.
Like, you know, let's not make this a week. You know, if you're going to do it. And again, I am not in favor of it, but make it like a once a year, once every 2 year thing. So it means something. If you start doing that shit every week, it means nothing other than the fact that someone's got to sit there and pull those damn thumbtacks out of some guy's back. I'm not a fan of all of thumbtacks.
You hate thumbtacks. And I don't blame you. And I also looked at it like, you know what? Eddie Kingston didn't need to have thumbtacks in his debut match. The thing last week, thumbtacks should be, in my opinion, for a blow-off match. You know, it's not something, a transitional or just an average match that you should be doing it. So I agree with you, Jeff. But Jeff, I got a couple of notes of stuff that I like.
Okay, sure.
There's some stuff I don't like with AEW. The women's division, obviously, we touched on. Just not working. Brandi Rhodes is a beautiful woman, and I'll leave it at that. I don't see anything compelling.
She got a doll.
Yeah, she did. You know what? I'd get that doll, actually. I liked it. She has a love doll, Jeff, or just a regular doll?
I think it's just a wrestling figure.
Oh, I don't want one of those. All right.
Well, but, you know, it's funny woman. Because Britt Baker, at this point, probably deserves the wrestling figure.
Oh, yeah.
Brandi Rhodes is married to Cody. That's why she apparently got it.
Right. And look, she's beautiful, and maybe she's doing
amazing. No question.
Maybe doing amazing things behind the scenes, but I'm just not seeing anything on camera that works for me. with that. Things I do like, Luchasaurus. Luchasaurus, when he breaks away and becomes a single star, this guy is going to be something big. And possibly it's a name change. Possibly the mask comes off. But you look at him, he has got size. He has got ability. I think we're looking at something big here. And I saw Luchasaurus again at a House of Hardcore show. And he's impressive. He just does some stuff that's really impressive. I don't think his future is with Marco Stunt and Jungle Boy, though. Tag team focus. I like the fact that there's this focus on tag team wrestling. It's not an afterthought. It's not throwing two guys together and just making shit happen. They make tag team wrestling seem really important. And that's something that the biggest company in the world for professional wrestling really hasn't done in years. You know, their focus for them for tag team is it's almost a throwaway. We've got to do it. We'll do it. But it's a waste for them. I definitely am not a huge fan of the way they do it. We talked about Eddie Kingston. When this guy gets going, this is going to be a big star. I'm excited to see that. I like clean finishes. We briefly touched on it. The fact that they're doing clean finishes, it shows me that it's important. This is important to present something to the fans of wins and losses, and I really like that. The biggest takeaway that I get from this, it's the overall presentation of the product. It's fresh and it's vibrant. You're not taking guys that were main, you know, Cody Rhodes was not a main event guy. Chris Jericho hasn't been main event for years. A lot of these, John Moxley, I guess, to some degree was main event, but the majority of these guys are not main event wrestlers from other territories or promotions. But yet the way they're being presented in AEW as a main event talent and the way that the whole thing is being structured, this comes off as fresh and vibrant, exciting and compelling to me. And I like that. And Bill Watts, and I've said this multiple times, Bill Watts could take a turd and shine it up and make me watch it. And, you know, I remember Bill Watts doing this stuff with Chavo Guerrero and Gary Young and then Steve Cox. And these were not guys that were main event guys, you know, Chavo to some degree, but certainly Gary Young and Steve Cox. But yet it was so interesting what Bill Watts was doing with it. Bill Watts took Wild Bill Irwin and Bad Leroy Brown and made them tag team champions. And I liked it. I watched it. You know, so I like that. I think when you've got interesting booking, when you present something and you do it the right way, it's compelling to the viewership. And this is, I think, the strength of AEW right now.
I will say that I disagree with one of the things you said, what? But only to a very small degree. Sure. Luchasaurus and Jake Hager. Okay. Two big guys. I think they put them in the ring together too soon. I think that's.
Oh, yeah.
That could have been a money match down the road. If you keep those, you know, I have to say, for all the good and bad that you can say about ECW, one of the things that Paul Heyman did in the early part of ECW was he created this guy called 911.
Yeah.
And 911, the only thing he would do was come out and choke slam somebody every week. Okay. You never saw him face off with somebody, so he never got exposed, okay? And Jake Hager looks great just standing there and in limited spots in a tag match, but there's no reason to have those guys face off in a tag match because what should happen is one of the guys should get in the ring, you know, like Jake Hager should be in the ring, and they tag in Luchasaurus, and then he tags out. Tease that for a couple of months, and then you set it up where you can put that as one of the semi-main events on a fucking pay-per-view because big guys always sell. That's one thing that Vince McMahon definitely had right because people would rather watch a match with two huge guys than watch Rey Mysterio versus, you know, Juventud Guerrero. Even though we both know and everyone else listening here knows that the small guys are going to have a much better match, but your average wrestling fan, they're going to want to watch the two big guys. And I think they've really kind of blown it by putting those two guys and having them face off. They need to keep those guys apart. Just like they kept, you know, like Andre, when he faced off with whoever his opponent was for whatever run in the WWE, they always kept them apart until they got to the big shows. And that's what they should have been doing with those guys. But you're right. Luchasaurus has got a big future. I think Jake Hager does too. You know, I mean, obviously he's got, you know, he's got a wrestling background. He did the MMA, stuff like that. He just needs to get a little bit smoother in a pro wrestling ring. And then I think he's got a big future, but these two guys could have been money. And I really hope they keep them apart and set them up for something down the road. Okay. Please continue, Barry.
So Jake Hager has been a bit of a disappointment to me thus far in AEW. I'll tell you what I did like was Jake Hager's wife. Huge, two big thumbs up for Jake Hager's. Yes. She's got money written. Boy, she's smoking hot. I mean, we're talking smoking hot, but comes off as like an asshole. So I was like, wow, she's got a big future. Jake, to me, has just been kind of a disappointment. You're right. They shouldn't have put these two guys together. And there's a third big guy in AEW that we haven't brought up, which is Wardlow with MJF. But they've yes. been kind of doing it right. Yes. He's had very, very, very few matches, and they haven't had him get beat down yet, really. I know he lost the cage match, I think, to Moxley. Was that right?
Yes. No, yeah. It was to Cody, because Cody did the spot off the top of the cage.
That's right. That it was to Cody, yeah. But, you know, I think protecting Wardlow is to their advantage, and I think protecting Jake Hager, and I think we're seeing too much of Jake Hager in the ring, because I'm not connecting with him.
Hager should be like Jericho's bodyguard, and that's it at this point, you know?
Yep, you're right.
Okay, so you got any other yays, nays, or myths?
No, I think overall what I like about AEW is the fact that when it seems to move also. It seems to move quickly, and I like that. Comparing it to the WWE again, WWE to me is stale. It is a stale. You could bring in the greatest wrestlers in the world, and it probably wouldn't matter at this point because the presentation is about as boring as fucking the worst vanilla ice cream known to man. There's just nothing there, and they've done a really good job. The other show that I'm liking, and I don't want to get too far off, but I've been watching Impact the last few weeks, and I got to tell you, after not watching Impact the last 3 years, they've got some really good stuff. There's some really good stuff. There was some ridiculous shit last week with the house. They're doing a wrestlers in a house concept, which is strictly comedy. But at the same time, some of the in-ring content has been fantastic. 2 weeks ago, they had a match, the Motor City Machine Guns versus the North. And, it was fantastic, Jeff. Absolutely just, you know, 4 stars, 5 stars. I loved it.
Well, I will just say that one of the things, as far as your complaints about the WWF or WWE and being stale, is I have read on more than one occasion that a show will be written out, the format will be laid out, and at the very last moment, Vince will come in and say, no, I want to change this, this, and this. And so it leaves the show in chaos, and it certainly was reflective on our the TV screens. And that's part of the reason why the television product is not up to snuff right now. And, you know, there are people that have called for Vince to step aside. That's not going to happen. But, you know, it's sometimes when you are in charge of a corporation like that, you need to let the people that you hire do their job. And I think Vince has a real problem letting go of that. And
you think
it's something that he's done for now for what? Almost going on 40 years. And it's hard for someone to let go of something that they've done for 40 years. But, you know, and obviously with the money they've gotten from Fox and all this kind of stuff, you know, and they just, I guess this last week they were expecting this horrible quarterly report and it completely blew them away in a positive manner. So yeah, I don't see Vince changing anything in the near future. That goes without saying. So Barry, real quick, I want to touch on something that was on television this past, I want to say Friday on Showtime, because we have, Barry, do we have an announcement coming?
We do have an announcement. So, okay.
Wait a minute. Referring to the Go-Go's documentary that was on Showtime, which I thought was fantastic. But of course, I've always been a big fan of the Go-Go's. And so the episode or the documentary, while I thought it was fantastic, I told Barry before we started recording that I saw, it might've been Benji Fido, who said it was essentially a behind the music, like a little bit expanded. So why don't you very quickly, because we have this announcement coming regarding next week's episode, and we'll just very briefly talk about our thoughts on the documentary, Gary.
Yeah, absolutely, too. So when Jeff was actually, Jeff and I were texting Friday night as this documentary was airing on Showtime, and I got to be honest, the first 20 minutes, I think my nipples were hard. I had goosebumps. It was, and I think I said to you, this is like Christmas has come early. I really loved the focus of the early punk stuff that was taking place. And I reached out to my man, Gabe Daigle. Gabe Daigle, who is a punk rock aficionado, but also new wave and the LA music scene. He was born and raised in Los Angeles. So he grew up, he's a little bit older than me. Gabe, maybe a lot older, but just kidding, Gabe. But he grew up and he saw a lot of these bands live and he said, wow, this is great. He loved it. So I reached out to somebody that appeared in the documentary that I've been friendly with. You know, I've been writing a book on music in new wave, but new wave, as you pointed out, you know, a couple of years ago, a lot of new wave, all the roots really come from punk. So I reached out to somebody that was in the documentary and I said, hey, would you like to come on our podcast, talk about the Go-Go's documentary? This is a person, Jeff, that lived with the Go-Go's. I mean, we're not just talking somebody that casually would wave to them. They actually shared a roof. They spent a lot of time together. And it's somebody whose name I've mentioned a couple times. Her name is Pleasant Gaiman. And she is an author. She was a lead singer of several punk bands that took place. She is an all-around raconteur, but a lot of people give her a lot of credit for developing and expanding punk in the United States. She was writers for all the top magazines, newspapers, LA Weekly, the Los Angeles Reader, the Hollywood Reporter, Variety, just a whole bunch. She would write punk rock columns for them. She is one of the most respected voices in the punk rock community. And as I mentioned, she lived with the Go-Go's. And I think Jane Wiedlin is one of her closest friends. So this is a huge fucking get for us that she is willing to do it. We would have had her on this week. She is under a deadline with her latest book, which is coming out. And I believe she's got multiple books that are out there. But there was a band, Jeff, called the Screamin' Sirens, and she was the lead singer in the 1980s for that band. So she will look at how excited Gunny is.
Gunny can't wait for the next next
Gunny's episode. Like excited. So I'm look.
Gunny's a punk rock aficionado.
I'm super excited. She would have been here this week, but she's got a deadline for her latest book. She will be joining us next week. She wants to talk about the Go-Go's documentary. She wants to discuss the Go-Go's, and she's going to drop some serious, serious knowledge when it comes to music and the Los Angeles music scene, not just punk rock, but overall. This is going to be a show that you are going to want to tune into.
Yeah, and one of the things that was brought up towards the end of the documentary, this isn't any big spoiler here, by, I believe the guy's name, was it Chris Connolly from Rolling Stone magazine?
Yeah, absolutely. Yep.
And Stuart Copeland, the drummer for the Police, both of them incredulous. And Barry and I know, Barry, how much you love Hall of Fames, but the Go-Go's, the very first group of its kind where all the women in the band played their own instruments, incredibly successful throughout the 80s, not in the Rolling Stone Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. And when you got a guy that's a writer for Rolling Stone and somebody with the credibility of Stuart Copeland, just incredulous. And so that's one of the things we'll talk about with our guest next week. I'm sure the documentary is running throughout the week on Showtime. If you have Showtime, I would encourage you to check it out because we will be discussing the documentary in much greater detail next week when we have our guest. And we will certainly be plugging that. So next, Barry, today, as the day we're recording, happens to be the 40th anniversary of a big deal in the old CWF, which, of course, everyone knows that's right in Barry's wheelhouse. So, Barry, let's talk a little about the anniversary, 40 years from the last Tangle in Tampa. Barry, before I start going through some of the matches that were featured on this card, tell us the memories that you have of this big show in Tampa Stadium.
Yeah, so this was, and right, it is 40 years today, too. This was a show that I wanted to go to, and even though I didn't live in Tampa, I lived in Miami Beach, I wasn't able to go, so it was something that always stuck with me, and I'd only seen one big card outdoors, and that was the Super Bowl of Wrestling, which had taken place a couple of years earlier. This was a big deal in the fact that it was positioned as Dusty Rhodes is going to win the World Heavyweight title. This is when it's going to happen. Dusty's going to win the World's Heavyweight title. So that was partly the reason I wanted to go, because I wanted to see a world title change. The card itself, while a very good card, is not so far out of the realm of what CWF was doing at the time to begin with. You know, there's a couple of guys that are on there that weren't in CWF. Bob Backlund coming in was kind of a big deal, obviously. But for the most part, a lot of these guys were already here. They were already in Florida. So a lot of angles were built around this. There was a mask versus mask match, which was a big deal between the Super Destroyer and Mr. Florida, which was their blow off after, three or four months of feuding. And that great angle, Jeff, too, where Sir Oliver Humperdinck gave the Super Destroyer his lit cigar and he put it in the eye of Mr. Florida. You know, and it kind of bothers me too, because all three of those guys are gone.
But it's interesting to note that I know that Paul Jones had told you when you interviewed him that one of the things that happened was that his Mr. Florida gimmick was over as on top of the cards. And he said when Dusty got back to Florida, he got pushed down the cards. Here he is on this big show, right smack dab in the lower middle of the card. So maybe there was something to what Paul was saying.
Yeah, well, look, there definitely was. And Butch Reed, we asked him that question, and Hacksaw was very, he didn't want to say anything. But, you know, look, there's a million stories out there. And Dusty, you know, we could certainly pinpoint him because maybe he was one of the bigger stars, but a lot of guys did that. A lot of guys, if they felt that their position in any form was being threatened, they would cut off the push. So what Paul was talking about during that interview was Paul felt that he came in, he was getting over huge, and he was, and Dusty came back, and Dusty never liked Paul Jones. They never got along, whether it was Crockett or Florida, and immediately stopped his push, and basically within a week or 2 weeks, it was a mask versus mask match. He lost it. He was unmasked and he left the state of Florida. And that was that. So we certainly heard that a lot coming from that. But this is a good card, too. And, some interesting things with this card. Bugsy McGraw on this card. What I like about it, Bugsy McGraw, one of the few guys that was on two world title changes in the state of Florida. The world title didn't change hands on this card. But Bugsy was there the night that Dory Funk Jr. won the world title. Didn't wrestle, but was in the building. He was joining Florida and I think debuted in the territory a week later or so. And then he was there the night that Dusty didn't win the title, which was in Tampa, which, you know, just a few months after this. But this is a good card. It just...
Was this the show or was it the year before where Dusty's gimmick was, I'll never wrestle Harley Race for the world title again?
I believe it was this show. And I think That's what they had built this around, was that Dusty says, if I don't, then I'm not going to. And of course, as in wrestling, you know, all these stipulations only last for a very, very short window of time.
Yeah. So let me go over the card real quick. We open up with a very young Scott McGee taking on Bill White, a veteran enhancement talent guy. Worked a lot of different areas. Second match, Jim Garvin versus Bobby Jaggers. Now, was this Bobby? This was Bobby just getting there. Would that be correct? Because Bobby was there in like 80 and 81, as I remember.
No, I think this was actually Bobby on more of the wind down.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, and I think this is where Jimmy, as a singles, he had been gone. Jimmy had been the Florida champion, Southern champion. He left, came back, but this would be the run where Jimmy had just come back and would eventually transition and turn heel.
Okay. Jerry Briscoe versus Lord Alfred Hayes. Then we had a 7-girl battle royal. Winner gets $10,000. That's a nice hunk of change for the ladies there, Bear.
Oh, yeah.
Jack Briscoe versus Mr. Saito. That probably would have been a hell of a match. Next, we have a Southern heavyweight title match as Dick Slater takes on a very young Barry Windham. That would have been a great match. The mask versus match that Barry mentioned with Mr. Florida taking on the Super Destroyer. Special event, Dick Murdoch and Bugsy McGraw take on Ivan Koloff and Nikolai Volkov. Next, we have a World Junior Heavyweight title match, Les Thornton versus Mike Graham. Next, Battle of the Giants, Andre the Giant versus the Big Cat, Ernie Ladd. A WWWF Heavyweight title match between Bob Backlund and Don Morocco. You know, I'm just curious. Morocco, had he already gone up to New York? Or was this, you know, because he had such a successful run, I'm wondering if this wasn't some sort of test run. And it was after this that he went up to New York where he had a successful run up there with Backlund.
That I don't know. I want to say he'd already spent some time up there, but this would have been in between those runs, I think.
Yeah. And then, of course, you had 2 out of 3 falls, special guest referee, the master of the Iron Claw, Fritz Von Erich. I'm sure he kept an even mind and was fair to both parties. The world champion Harley Race taking on the American Dream, Dusty Rhodes. Any idea, Barry? I know I'm putting you on the spot with this. What kind of gate they had, anything like that?
I think it was a pretty strong gate, too. I want to say it was almost 18,000 between. That's what the announce gate was, like between 17 and 18,000. So maybe realistically, maybe more like 15, you know, okay. But anything is possible. But yeah, strong card, too. If I'm correct, your old friend Larry Hamill, Jeff, Larry Hamill, who was writing, he was a sports writer for the Orlando Sentinel, wrote a scathing article on this card and on Dusty Rhodes especially, because this was where Dusty had said, if I don't, I'm going to quit or whatever it was. And it was a complete screw job at the end. I believe Dusty, people left the arena that night, the stadium, thinking that Dusty may have won the title, and Larry just went off in his column, which was kind of unusual to see somebody that was generally pro-professional wrestling just to lay it out there. But I think I got to find this article, but I'm pretty sure this was the one.
Okay, so now it is time for Barry's favorite part of our podcast, when we talk food. And this week, we are talking the best chicken restaurants that are out there. We are going worst to first, Barry. We are going to invite Sweet Lou to join us to chime in if he has any thoughts on any particular restaurant. So the first one, Barry, number 16, that would be the worst on the list. A place that apparently is primarily in truck stops, Champ's Chicken. Have you heard of it or ever had a chance to try Champ's Chicken?
Neither. When I saw it, I knew nothing about it. I got to say, too, this is Jeff will post the link. This is a video that's on YouTube, and we have done a lot of food talk on this show over the last 2.5 years. And this might be my favorite food related subject based off of how fucking awesome I thought this thing was put together. The woman doing the commentating is fantastic. The points that she's made, which I'm sure were written for her, are clear and concise. I walked away and I was like, wow, I'm really fucking impressed. But to that end, Jeff, I've never heard of Champ's Chicken.
So I will say that apparently as it's a truck stop place where that's like where all their locations are. And of course, you know, the first thing that comes to your mind is, why would I get fried chicken at a truck stop? But later on down the list, we have a place that is primarily in gas stations. And Barry, I don't know if I told you this, the place I'm going to mention later, they have a location right here in Greater Cumming, Georgia. So perhaps next weekend and I, Mrs. Bowder and I will take one for the team and go to that location. When I get to it, I'll mention it. Next up, oh, Barry, a disappointing showing for Boston Market at number 15. Barry, are you a fan of Boston Market?
So I was, I guess, at one point, and we're going to go back 15 or 20 years ago, a little bit of trivia. When my wife and I were dating, my wife was
the halcyon days.
the halcyon days, the salad days, if you will, Jeff, which throwing a vegetable reference out there. But she was a vegetarian, and she was a vegetarian for the first 2 years of our relationship. She broke that on a trip to Boston Market. And then literally within an hour, she was vomiting out in the street. So
go well for her, huh?
Yeah, not the most ringing endorsement ever. But at the same time, Boston, I always felt was good. I actually preferred Kenny Rogers Roasters because it was the wood that made it good over Boston. But Boston had it all. They had meatloaf. They had their chicken. But this video brings up a great point that why would you go to Boston Market when you can go to Costco and get a $4.99 complete chicken now? It doesn't make sense. Or you can go to any of your grocery stores and get a rotisserie chicken for $5 or $6.
Publix has a lovely...
Yeah.
I think it's a lemon pepper chicken.
Yes, that's right. And it's fantastic, too. Yeah. So
Okay. Yeah. I will say that, Boston Market, before it became Boston Market, was called Boston Chicken. And when they first came out on the market, if you will, I thought they were really good. And as Barry says, as a place gets more successful and they start cutting back on certain things, in this case, what they did was they went from Boston Chicken to Boston Market. They expanded their menu. And in doing so, I think their chicken really started to suffer. I used to go to Boston Market probably once a month because it was right down the street from the courthouse where I worked. And one of the things they pointed out here is about a few of these places, and Barry's talked about this before when we talk about places like Carrabba's, a lot of it depends on the location you go to. It's very hit or miss. You can go to a Boston Market here, and your food is terrible, and you go to the one, 5 miles down the road, and your meal is completely fine. But definitely when they expanded their menu, I thought the chicken itself really started kind of going and became very hit or miss, Bear.
Yeah, and that's what I like about the commentator too. The woman that's doing the commentating for this video, she also says that Boston Market was great. However, at this, the quality has gone way down. So it's a very, very fair assessment. I haven't been into Boston in a while, so I can't tell you. I did like it. But, you mentioned that lemon pepper chicken from Publix. If you've never had that rotisserie chicken, if you're near a Publix, run out right. Put a mask on. Run out right now. Get a chicken because it's out of this world.
So the next two I'm gonna mention together because there's a connection. And number 14 is KFC, which, we don't call them Kentucky Fried Chicken anymore. And at number 13, one spot in front of it is a place called Lee's Famous Chicken. Now, the reason there's a connection is apparently the guy that started Lee's Famous Chicken was a relative of Harlan Sanders that essentially was alleged, I'm going to say alleged because I'm not 100% positive, to have taken Harlan Sanders' famous recipe and started his own chain. It's primarily a Midwestern chain. And as I was looking on the old Google to see if there was one in my area, I happened to notice, Barry, that there was one located, like I said, primarily a Midwestern chain. And there was one located in the town of Belle Fountain, Ohio. And the reason that rang a bell with me is my wife's sister-in-law lives in Belle Fountain, Ohio with her husband. And so I reached out to her and I said, what we're doing this show about, chicken places. And I noticed that there is a Lee's Famous Chicken in your town. Have you ever happened to have the occasion to check this place out? And what did you think about it? Good, bad, and different, that kind of thing. She said, well, we used to have a Lee's chicken. It's the worst chicken. It has way too much pepper. We went there once and never went back. Also, not the cleanest place either. So Lee's getting the boot from my wife's sister-in-law. And so just wanted to throw that out there.
Would that make her your sister-in-law as well?
Well, no, it's my wife's sister-in-law from the first husband.
Ah, there you go. Gotcha. All right.
But that's her sister-in-law, Annette. I'll give her some props there, Bear. So we appreciate Annette participating in Breaking Kayfabe with Bowdrin and Barry. So, we have spoken on more than one occasion about KFC, the good points. And, the point that they raise on this particular YouTube video that Barry's discussed is that KFC, the extra crispy is way too crispy. The original recipe, very hit or miss, but the mashed potatoes and gravy are good and the biscuits are good. Sometimes the mashed potatoes are hit and miss too. The biscuits, though, are usually pretty consistent, Barry. But since this is about chicken specifically, I'm going to give it a hit or miss. I've never been to a Lee's Famous Chicken. I read the comment that my wife's sister-in-law had. So anybody out there in the group, and I know we have people from the Midwest that have been to a Lee's Famous Chicken, I'm curious as to what the group feels. So next, Barry, number 12, Church's Fried Chicken.
I like Church's. I haven't eaten. You know where there was a Church's, Jeff, for our South Florida folks? You remember Jackson's Ice Cream?
Yes. There was you're right. Right across the street.
Right across. There's like an IHOP right there and a Church's. So we used to go to Church's and then we would go get ice cream at Jackson's. I always liked Church's. I always felt it was a quality chicken. It's been 25, 30 years since I've had it. But yeah, it was good.
Yeah. Next, a place I don't recall ever being Church's. If I went maybe once. Next on the list at number 11, Zaxby's. Now, I can tell you, Barry, that there is a Zaxby's right down the street from where we live. We went there once. Got to be honest, wasn't totally blown away.
No, Zaxby's is okay. It's I think it's big down south. I know when I drive from Pennsylvania to Florida, almost every exit has got a sign for Zaxby's chicken. So we've gotten it. They did show that one sandwich, and we did get that once. I think it's chicken tenders.
Yeah, the one on Texas toast?
Yes, it's on Texas toast with like ranch and hot sauce. That's actually pretty good. That I have gotten.
Okay, the next one, another place I went to when we were up in Missouri for my friend Mona and Jim's daughter's wedding, and that is Raising Cane. I actually was very impressed with Raising Cane, although, as specified in the video, all they make is chicken strips. You know, your chicken fingers type of product. They don't do any sort of leg or a breast or wing or anything like that. It's strictly chicken strip. But Barry, I tried it and I enjoyed it. Have you ever tried Raising Cane?
I tried it this past January when I was in Boston, and there's one right near Boston University. So I went.
Terriers.
There you go. Mark Beaudry, this is for you, my friend. He lives right near there. But I was a little disappointed, and I'll tell you why. I thought the chicken strips were fine. I had no, they didn't blow me away. I thought they were good. The only issue I run into is they offer one dipping sauce. It's the Raising Cane's dipping sauce, and that's it. So you don't have this variety of barbecues and all this stuff. There is no barbecue sauce, right? It's like ketchup and Raising Cane sauce. So I thought it was good. I don't know if I left there and I said, this is amazing. And I didn't. I guess maybe I had built it up in my head after 2 or 3 years of wanting to try it and then finally trying it and going, that's it. You know, I expected more, but hey, maybe it's on me. Sweet Lou, have you ever tried Raising Cane's?
I did get to try Raising Cane's when I was in Las Vegas last summer. And I got to say the product is solid. And, you know, people are raving about the dipping sauce, too. And I'm like, it's got a unique flavor. But, you know, the chicken fingers themselves are pretty tasty. And I forget what else they had there. Was it like, it wasn't biscuits, was it? Or I think it was just chicken fingers and fries. Was that it?
Yeah, it's a pretty basic menu.
Yeah.
Which, I mean, based on what I said about Boston Market, at this point, I got to give them props for not expanding their menu into, you know, starting to have roast beef sandwiches, and they start screwing up their chicken product.
Yeah.
So before we get to number 9 in a place that I know that Lou has been to, Barry, what person that you're a fan of is a graduate of Boston University?
Howard Stern.
You got it right. I should say that you used to be a fan of, because that's right, you're really not as big a fan of Howard as you used to be, as I recall. So number 9, and Lou has told me off air that he's been to this place, Barry. So we're going to anxiously and breathlessly await for Lou's report, because this is a place that's primarily on the West Coast. And that is Bonchon, which is a place that is primarily does a Korean style chicken. Lou, what'd you think?
Yeah, I've been there once.
That counts.
Yes. Thank God. Yeah. They have one in South San Francisco, which I got to go to. I'm a fan of Korean food in general, and I think the Korean take on fried chicken is, by and large, pretty tasty. So it was, I had no complaints about what I had there.
Barry, in your visits to the West Coast, have you ever tried Bonchon?
I have not. I have had Korean chicken, especially Korean chicken wings, multiple times. There is a concept down at the Jersey Shore called Crunchin' Chicken, which does Korean chicken, which is fantastic. And then there's a couple of Korean restaurants local to my area that do it. What makes it unique is that it's double fried, is that you're getting fried chicken that's been double fried. The one drawback, if you're going to a sit-down restaurant, it can take 20 and 30 minutes to get the chicken when they do it fresh. Going to Banchan or a fast casual restaurant, I'm sure it's a lot quicker. That was the one drawback. But I will say Korean chicken may be some of the best chicken you can ever get.
Okay, our next selection on the list is at number 8. And I think a bit of a controversial choice, as I'm not really sure it belongs with the other places we listed. Barry, that's Wingstop. So this is a place that primarily does wings. It doesn't really do the type of chicken that some of the other places we mentioned. Have you been to Wingstop?
I have. So we had a Wingstop, which I think we still have, in Philadelphia, and it was owned by a Philadelphia Eagle at the time. So I went in maybe 10 years ago, maybe even longer, and my son, Zach was a young boy at this time, and his favorite food is chicken wings, and I got him a gift card, and I told the manager, I said, yeah, it's for my son. It's for Christmas. I think he was 7 years old or 8 years old. His favorite food is wings. They wound up giving me t-shirts and all this like swag stuff. And I was like so impressed that they did that. I thought that was so cool. Their wings are really good. Again, it's only wings. The wings are meaty. They're cooked properly. And the sauces are fantastic. So I do like Wingstop. I'm a fan.
And they have a more than one as far as the selection of sauces goes.
Yes, there's more than one, which is good. Thank God, Jeff.
So before we get to the next one on our list, I want to mention that I reached out to Barry the other day, speaking of chicken, and I was watching an episode of a show on the Food Network called Food Paradise or something like that. And there was a place in Philadelphia that serves chicken and donuts. And Barry, what's the name of that place? Because you mentioned you had been there.
Federal Donuts.
With Federal Donuts. So what kind of concept is that, Barry? And did you enjoy it?
So I did. So it actually, there are several. The one that you pointed out was the one that's on Sansom Street in Philadelphia. The original.
I'm sure Chulminski's been there.
Well, you know, he would have been to the one that's on Federal Street, which was the first location. And what's cool about it is when you go in, they have these, it's like an old fashioned counter. So they've got those spinny seats. Remember those from
Counter? Yeah.
I never see those anymore. They've got those kind of seats. And you order a combination, it comes together, of fried chicken. It's two pieces of fried chicken, some French fries, and every order comes with a donut. And I just thought, to me, that's like such a cool concept. There's probably three or four of these right now. The fried chicken's excellent. It is super, super crispy on the outside. So when you bite into it, you literally are hearing this cracking and this crispiness. And the chicken is moist and juicy. So you really can't ask for more than that.
Okay, getting back to our list at number 7. Oh, we've discussed them before, Barry. Bojangles. And this is one of those places, much like we mentioned before with Boston Market and some of the other national chains. Lots depends on the location you go to, you know, for whether or not that's going to be a high quality place or you're going to get a little bit lesser quality. Bojangles, by the way, stellar biscuits. Great sweet tea. The chicken is a hit or miss product, though, Barry, in my view. What do you think about Bojangles?
Yeah, so I've had, and you know, you said it, and actually the commentator says it, that it varies by location. Consistency per location is not really key here. I have had an amazing experience at Bojangles before, and then I've had a much less than amazing experience at Bojangles. So I think it does depend. What I like about Bojangles, A, the biscuits are phenomenal, but that you can get a biscuit with chicken, bacon, and egg. You know, they do all these special kinds of biscuits, especially for breakfast, which I think is all day, right? Don't they do breakfast all day?
Okay, the next one on the list, Crispy Crunchy Chicken, Barry. Now, what's interesting about Crispy Crunchy Chicken, as I mentioned earlier in this segment, it is primarily in gas stations, but gets very positive reviews. I was expecting this not to be this high on the list. And in fact, there is one located right here in the greater Cumming, Georgia area. So I hope this coming weekend for Mrs. Bowdrin and I to give it a look and see our own personal thoughts, which maybe I'll share with the audience on the next episode. Have you ever been to a Crispy Crunchers chicken?
I have, Jeff, and I'm about to drop some important advice.
You're going to break kayfabe?
Yes, and sir, I want you to heed this advice when you do visit this actual location. So we have one at a gas station that is maybe the closest gas station to my house. And they opened up 2 or 3 years ago in the gas station. And somebody said, have you tried the fried chicken in the gas station? And I laughed it off, like, really? And they said, trust me on this one. You're going to want to try it. So I headed over for lunch and I tried it and I was blown away. It was hot, flavorful. It was crunchy. The sides were, the sides were hit and miss, but the chicken was fantastic. And it was a little spicy with the breading, like maybe a Cajun kind of Creole spice, because they also have a Cajun Creole dipping sauce that I thought was out of this world. The key with this is if you go at an off time, meaning if you're not going during either the lunch or dinner hour, the chicken is either sitting around for a half an hour, or they have to then make it fresh for you, which means you're standing in a gas station for the next 10 minutes. So I had good and bad experiences there. I haven't been in quite a while because I think the last few times I went, I was really just kind of like, ugh. And what also bothered me was, and I don't know if this is accurate in all the locations, the person who was running the indoor gas station, which was also a convenience store, was also making the chicken. And I don't think she had a ton of training when it came to food preparation. And that kind of concerned me. She knew how to ring up shit on a register. I just don't know if she knew proper food handling techniques. And I got a little skeeved out by that.
Yeah, it does mention in the video that there is a Cajun touch to some of the side. They mentioned the biscuits, Bear. Did you try the biscuits there?
They were very good, yes.
That's what they say good in the video. So yeah. Next up on our list, we have, and I believe this is a West Coast place, Lou, if you want to chime in, Jollibee. Barry, I can say that I have not. Have you ever tried Jollibee?
I have not. And somebody posted, and I want to say if it was one of our California listeners, maybe a year or two ago, and they posted about how good the chicken was at Jollibee, and then they showed the logo, and I'm like, I got to get a fucking t-shirt from this place, but I have never been to a Jollibee.
Yes, Jollibee is one of the biggest fast food chains in the Philippines, and they move stateside. Actually, they opened their first United States location here in Daly City, California. Just south of San Francisco, which happens to have one of the biggest Filipino populations. So I've definitely eaten there. I had their fried chicken one time, and it came with some sort of weird gravy, and I just did not dig it. So every time I've been back there, I've had essentially their egg rolls called Lumpia Shanghai. So I hear raves about it, so perhaps I should go back and give it another shot.
Okay, next on our list, another West Coast place. We're going to get Lou's thoughts on this, is El Pollo Loco. Lou, what do you think of this place?
I do like it. There really aren't many around me, but whenever I do see...
Primarily Los Angeles-based, they do mention that.
Yeah. But, I've seen them elsewhere, like in the Sacramento area, the San Jose area. And, if I do go by it and I'm hungry, I certainly have no qualms about getting one of their rotisserie chicken dishes. It's really good with a good citrusy marinade, and then really good sides, beans, rice, whatever. So always been a fan.
And Barry, in one of your many trips to California, have you ever tried El Pollo Loco?
I think I did. I think I tried it 3 years ago when I was there. I went to I would say it was Pollo Tropical, but I don't think they have those in Los Angeles. And I know it's a very similar concept. So I would have to assume that I tried. It was very good, actually.
Next up, Barry, is a place I can actually recommend. And that is at number 3, PDQ. Barry, your thoughts on PDQ?
I love PDQ. And what I like, so it's similar to Raising Cane's, but they actually give you an option. I think it's like 6 or 9 dipping sauces. They've got a great selection. My first time at a PDQ going back about 4 or 5 years ago, and I had never been. So I asked the manager and he said, I'll give you one of every sauce if you want, which I thought was great. But he said, the one that you really want to try is the creamy garlic. And I got to tell you, this guy was spot on the money. That creamy garlic was fantastic. So PDQ, I know that they've had some issues and people have posted in our group about the closures out west. The ones near me, and there's nothing right around the corner, they're all in New Jersey. They're always busy, though, when I go. So I like PDQ. I'm a big fan of what they do.
Lou, have you been to a PDQ?
Alas, no.
Okay. I have. There was one right on the old Federal Highway in Oakland Park Boulevard. Don't know if it's still there with all the places that have closed because of the pandemic, but I loved it. I love their chicken, but more importantly, outside of maybe McDonald's, I think they have the best French fries of any remotely fast food joint out there. Unfortunately, Mrs. Bowdrin was not a fan.
What?
So it was not a place. I know. Not a place. By the way, I will mention it upcoming the day after this podcast drops, Mrs. Bowdrin's birthday, guys. Yay!
Yay!
So again, she will be 23 years old, my child bride. But she was not a fan of PDQ, so we did not go often, which was a little disappointing to me because I really enjoy PDQ. For you South Florida folks, I think there's also one on the old 17th Street Causeway. Unfortunately, as I checked, none in Georgia, Barry. That's a little disappointing. Next at number 2, Popeyes. Barry, your thoughts on Popeyes?
So this is a tough one, and this is I'm going to break this discussion open for both of you with this one. The chicken itself at Popeyes is very good. That chicken sandwich is amazing. That is an amazing chicken sandwich from the bun to the chicken. What bothers me about Popeyes, at least locations I've been to, is the cleanliness factor. There is the closest Popeyes to us. My kids were begging. We went and as you sat in the dining room, there were flies and those little small gnats everywhere, just buzzing you as you're eating. I got to admit, that is disgusting, and there is zero excuse for why that should be happening. A week or two after we ate there, I'm reading the local health inspections, and they were shut down for the fly infestation. But if you work and or own or manage a restaurant, cleanliness and keeping your insects and your vermin in control is a really top priority. And if you can't do that, that should be frightening to people that are going there to eat. So that was a really big deal to me. So my question to both of you is, how important, take out the food, it could be the greatest food you've ever had, how important is cleanliness and service to you when you go to, let's say, a quick serve restaurant? And the reason I'm bringing that up is my opinion only, Chick-fil-A and In-N-Out Burger, when it comes to cleanliness and service, are head and shoulders above any other concept. I don't think Chick-fil-A has the best chicken by any stretch. However, I will go to Chick-fil-A over Popeyes based off of the service and the cleanliness. Where do you guys stand on that?
Well, let me just say this. First of all, any place, any restaurant that's ever on one of these restaurant lists where, you know, the health department has gone there and issued them a warning or shut them down, we're never going to again because Mrs. Bowdrin won't go back. That being said, you know, I watch these shows like Gordon Ramsay. And I watched this show on the Food Network. Mrs. Bowdrin says it's all about her. Truly, it is. There's a show called, I think it's called Restaurant Impossible with a guy named Robert Irvine. And one of the things I think with Robert Irvine that said, he said it, is it costs you nothing as a restaurant owner or a restaurant manager to keep your place clean. And absolutely, that's first priority with me. If I go in there and the place looks like a dump, chances are I'm probably not even going to order the food. Lou?
Well, along with cleanliness and service, there's also availability. There, as far as Chick-fil-A itself, the nearest one to me would probably be about half an hour away. But that being said, I gotta say, sometimes I grade on a curve where if the place is dodgy on service, but they have a great product, yeah, I'll go there, perhaps not as often as I would if we had an excellent experience. And there's also where popularity comes into it as well, especially with fast food or quick service restaurants. If there wasn't a long-ass line at every In-N-Out Burger in town, I could go there 2-3 times a week. As it is, though, I consider it an occasional treat, like maybe once every couple of weeks. So it's a victim of its own success, I guess.
You know, Barry, you were sitting there talking about if a place has a reputation maybe for not being the cleanest place that you'd want. You know, but I remember a young Barry Rose, a pre-marriage Barry Rose. Weren't you one of those guys that would go with Howard Baum to the strip joints for Meatloaf Monday? So, you know, do the strip joints have the best reputation for clean? I don't know. But so are you saying, just to clarify, that our number one choice, by the way, is Chick-fil-A. That's number one on the list. So given the choice between a clean Popeyes and a clean Chick-fil-A, do you find the food better at Popeyes?
I do. Yes.
You do.
Yes.
Bit of a controversial selection. I will say that my wife introduced me to the new chicken sandwich with the new special sauce. And that was excellent. I just so happened last week, my wife brought home Popeyes where they forgot to include the special new sauce. And I found the chicken sandwich to be kind of ordinary, to be honest with you. But it was just a plain chicken sandwich. You know, when I go to Chick-fil-A, I usually like to get the spicy chicken. But the, it would probably be a push, to use a Dave Flaherty term, you know, as to which one I like better, the new Popeyes sandwich or the spicy chicken sandwich. But, you know, again, I certainly think that we can take into account what you said regarding the, the cleanliness factor. That's certainly something to take into consideration. Obviously, if you go into a restaurant and there's flies, you know, all over the place and buzzing around your food, that's really going to sort of dampen your spirit for the food. I think that anyone would agree with that, Barry.
Yeah, it does too. And it to me, it's a real shame because, you know, the amount of business that Popeyes was doing, and I was blown away. Like, I thought that chicken sandwich was so good. But at the same time, when you're sitting around and it's not even the flies were buzzing, these were like those little irritating fruit fly type of gnats that would get in your beverage and just, you know, it was disgusting. And it's inexcusable. And there's the old adage that if you truly want to know the cleanliness of a restaurant, just walk in the bathroom. And if the bathroom is gross, that means the kitchen is gross. And, you know, if the dining room is gross, Jeff, imagine how fucking disgusting the kitchen is, you know?
Good point. Fair point.
Yeah.
So as we get ready for the go home, Bear, a couple of things I wanted to note from the world of wrestling. I believe today, the day we recorded, would have been the birthday of one, an old friend of ours, Barry. I'm just kidding. Apache Bull Ramos. And it's also, I think he would be 80. He would have been 83. I want to do this just for Kevin Orcutt. And also, it is the 7-year anniversary of the death of Dutch Savage. Two guys very well associated with the Pacific Northwest. But I wanted to ask you, Barry, Bull Ramos and Dutch Savage, did either one of them spend any time in the Florida rings?
No, bizarrely. And I think Bull Ramos would have been a great addition at some point. I don't know if Bull came to the East Coast other than working in the WWWF in the 1960s.
Yeah, I was going to say mid to late 60s. Yeah.
Yeah. I don't think he ever spent much time. I think he was strictly a West Coast guy. But no, neither one of these guys spent any time in Florida. Today also, Jeff, the birthday of Carl Gotch, the Carl Gotch that you met. Yes, you met the man. The
interviewed
legend.
Him. Yes.
Yeah.
So yes, a luminary of beyond distinction to the fans in Japan as far as wrestling. I'm trying to figure if it was him or Thez that was called the God of Wrestling. I don't want to credit.
It was. It was Gotch.
Yeah, and trained so many of the guys. So influential in the training of guys like Maeda, Fujiwara, all the guys that were so Sayama. So many of the guys that were influential in the UWF in Japan in the mid-80s were all Carl Gotch students. And So yeah, it's a great mention, Barry. Also, finally, before we end the show, Barry, a couple of weeks ago, we happened to feature a match with Mark Rollerball Rocco taking on Chris Adams. And lo and behold, a couple of days ago, we learned of the death of Mark Rocco. Just amazing the timing of that, Barry. But we mourn the passing of Mark Rollerball Rocco, another guy tremendously influential to a whole generation of British wrestlers that came up while he was there and after. And so we raise an adult beverage to the memory of Mark Rollerball Rocco. Barry, anything else before we go?
No, I think it's time to wrap this one up.
Yeah, and again, our special guest next week will be
Pleasant Gaiman. Be here for this one.
Dirt will be flung next week. Unless I forget, Breaking Kayfabe is a production of the Arcadian Vanguard Podcast Network. Special thanks to Lou Kippelman, the sweet man, who, contrary to rumors started apparently by Ryan Damon, is not getting his own show on the Arcadian Network, even though he may deserve one. Ryan starting scurrilous rumors. Thanks again for all your efforts, Lou, and folks, we'll see you next week.